You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his three decades as a major league manager, Tony La Russa developed a reputation as an innovator and as one of the game's best thinkers and strategists. In the dugout and in the clubhouse, he was known for his single-mindedness toward seizing the moment, the pitch, the inning, the game, and the series. And that led to World Series rings with the 1989 Oakland A's and the 2006 and 2011 St. Louis Cardinals. Along the way, his leadership qualities have influenced not only players and managers, but also writers and the CEOs of major companies. In his new book, One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball, 10 and a Half Games Back, and One Final Championship Season, Tony La Russa relives last year's improbable championship season and his decision to leave the game that he loves. The book is published by William Morrow, and it brings him back to our show today. Welcome back.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
What were the main reasons you decided to retire at the end of the 2011 season? You want to go out a winner?
No, and that's just, you know, I get credit for leaving on top when it was a fairy tale finish and accidental. I had decided about midseason that enough was enough. And the last 3 or 4 years, you know, we stress a lot of personalizing in our approach. I say our because our coaching staff, myself, as we try to lead our players, we stress personalizing, and meaning that you take the responsibility for your contribution to our team. So if you do that, then you should personalize yourself. And I was always checking myself, and I was realizing things were bothering me more. It was getting harder and harder. So finally, about midseason, I said, this is it.
Well, midseason, you look pretty dire. But you talk about an incident that took place in spring training against the Washington Nationals that also had an effect on you and led to thoughts of retirement.
You know, I was involved with really a wonderful writer, Buzz Bissinger.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you were on the show with him
last
time.
Exactly. And this was after the 2003 season. And in my discussions with him, because Buzz, and we just talked, and Buzz accumulated it all, and with his talent, he produced a really well-written book. One of the things that I didn't really understand and realize until we had those discussions was that there was one thing that really got under my skin more than losing, and that was the responsibility that I had undertaken since a rookie manager to protect your players, meaning we didn't believe this or not. Some people who competed against us do not believe this, but I'm telling every team that I was ever with heard the speech. We never hit a player just because he was getting a lot of hits against us. We never did. We just pitched him differently, hopefully tougher, better. But part of the code was if somebody tries to take your offense away from you, then you must retaliate.
If they hit your player.
Right.
And you had some players who they would love to hit, like Albert Pujols.
Sure. Some guys would do it. You know, it's a mean of intimidation and paying a penalty for being so good. Well, you can't allow that. Now, many clubs, that gets decided among them players, which causes a lot of strife and can tear at your teamwork. So I made that decision myself for years. I would watch every game. And that decision, when you know it's a very serious decision, you have to make this analysis that it was intentional. You have to figure out what your response is when. Very, very painful. And I really went through a lot of changes. Even when, let's say, you were pitching, Leonard, against us and you had that reputation and we were going to face you Saturday. As soon as I knew you were going to pitch against us, I started thinking, oh, boy, when that day comes, I don't want it to start, but I got to be ready. Really agonizing. So in spring training of 2011, we had an incident with Washington where Chris Carpenter, who was wild that day, hit a hitter. Their team thought that he had done it intentionally, and they responded by hitting one of our guys. Their manager is a really good friend of mine, Jim Riggleman. I was really disappointed in him because he knows that we don't hit guys first. And as it turned out, there was retaliations later, and there was some yelling back and forth. When it was over, I thought, man, you know, This stuff is wearing me out. And then there was one analysis by a veteran broadcaster on another place that said, you know, I don't know how anybody plays for that guy. He's always starting stuff. I thought, you know, I'm just tired of of this stuff.
But you must miss the competition. You're a very competitive person.
Well, that's the perfect observation. You know, I was raised competing. I love competing. I think, as opposed to many who think that being a competitor is some kind of not-to-be-admired trait, I think
it all depends on how you do it.
Yeah, if you compete where you do the very, you prepare to be the best you can, and you do the best you can, and somebody beats you, you tip your cap. You don't take cheap shots. I think it's a great ability and motivation to have.
But so what don't you miss?
I don't miss the dugout, being in the trenches there and having the responsibilities and going through this the decision-making process. I don't miss that. So in our game, the only way to continue to compete is to do it out of uniform with a team someplace, and someday I think I will. Right now I'm very fortunate the commissioner has allowed me to stay close to the game, being on assignment for him on a very often basis.
I always wonder what happens during spring training when one of your best players suddenly gets hurt. That happened last year when Adam Wainwright went down in spring training. I mean, what do you think at that moment? You've just lost your top pitcher.
Well, you know, everything, if you ask me something like that, I'm going to give you an answer, and I think it's important to explain. There isn't anything about the answer that is something that I figured out myself. I've been a student for 50 years. I've been mentored by the best, and if I'm anything, I'm a good learner, good student. And one of the things that you get taught as the manager when the season starts, there are a number of ways that you need to separate your club from the other club, the edges that you try to pick up. You know, how you improve from team to, from game to game is, you know, you have to address mistakes, for example. Well, the other one that's very obvious is everybody has adversity. And some teams deal with it better than others. So we have a strategy for when adversity hits. And then we had this spectacular example where we lost Adam Wainwright early in spring training, and we had to address it then. And it wasn't the last time. By the way, the story of our 2011 season was continual injuries and adversity.
Well, I'm thinking now about the Jets. Darryl Revis just went down, their best player. And I guess you just, as a manager, as a coach, you just have to assume that this is part of the game. You have to have a backup plan. But can you have a backup plan when you lose your best pitcher?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just like Darryl Revis. What you don't assume is that it's going to happen automatically. And players have to be told, hey, listen. In fact, the best explanation I ever heard was Lou Holtz, who I used to read him religiously and had I've learned a lot from him about adversity. He would say, everybody has it. Then you concentrate on what you have, not what you don't have, and you will point out to your team, look, these are all our assets. By the way, there is going to be somebody playing in Revis's case or somebody's going to pitch in Wainwright's case. The important thing is you don't give into it.
You also pulled off a trade for Colby Rasmus toward the end of July that really was very helpful. Some of those trades don't work out. Did you have a sense that this was one that really might work, or do you have a sense that every trade is going to work?
You know, it's interesting you point that out. I think in the story of this book, the reason we wrote this book was to try to explain to people who have asked, how'd you guys come back? How'd you win as an underdog? In that story,
because you were so far back in midseason,
10.5.
People were wondering whether you're even going to make 500
by right.
The end of the season.
Yeah, we're 10.5 back with 32 to play. That story has a very compelling point midseason, which every team that's in contention maybe has to decide at that point, are we buyers or sellers at the trading deadline end of July? And we were right on the border because technically we were close to Milwaukee, but we were only plus six, which is not a very strong record. And we were asked, if we make this trade, can we win? Which is a great question to ask our coaches. We took that very seriously. And we said we bet on the guts that our team has shown through the first half. They never gave in. And we had guys, Wainwright, and we had broken bones and fractured legs. I mean, it was ridiculous. Never gave in, so we bet on the guts, and we said, yes, somebody like Colby who brought, you know, four or five players, we would be a better team. We could win, and in the end we did, but it got very, very shaky there for a while.
My guest is Tony La Russa, who with Rick Hummel has written a book called One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball, 10 and a Half Games Back, and One Final Championship Season. He also has a foreword by a guy who knows how to write best-selling books, John Grisham. You played most of your career when you were a ball player in the minor leagues. Do you think a lot of the best managers have pretty much come out of the minor leagues, and sometimes the great stars have had difficulty becoming good managers? Is it because they expect everybody to perform on the level that they performed on?
I make a point in Last Strike to tell you my understanding of that. I do think you find a lot of players who were not successful stars who end up staying in coaching and managing. But I was corrected by a terrific mentor, a legendary coach who worked for the St. Louis Cardinals for over 60 years. His name was George Kissel. And George had this formula. It's not whether you were a good or lousy player. It was whether you loved the game and had a desire to learn it. And I really believe that that's the truth. So therefore, you see a guy who's a star player like Joe Torre, Don Baylor. I mean, these guys are outstanding men. I could name, you know, Jim Fregosa. There's been a number of guys
who
are outstanding.
Don Mattingly,
exactly. What do we have in common, the guys who are lousy versus the stars? I think it's what George said. Love the game, want to learn it.
You, as we said, your team was 10 games out of first place at the end of July. What did you do as a manager to help your team claw its way back to become a wild card team in the playoffs? You can't give them that rah-rah speech, can you? They've been hearing those rah-rah speeches ever since they were in Little League.
Well, it's a good point about the speeches, because you're limited to how many times you can call a meeting. Call too many and they'll tune you out. Call too few and you're not communicating enough. So there is a day-to-day communication as a staff we use, just part of establishing relationships, which is one of the key things about our leadership style. But when we struggled, the thing that is so important is to try to identify why the struggle. Are you trying too hard? Well, relax. If you're not trying hard enough, then you better try harder. What we did was mid-August, after the trade, we got a little discouraged for the first time all year. It hadn't been the injuries, hadn't been other adversity. It's because Milwaukee went crazy. And all of a sudden, said, after all this swimming upstream, it's getting away from us, and we got discouraged. And so the reminder was just, hey, we're going to play the last 30 games to the same level. And if we're not good enough, we're not good enough, but we're going to be able to look in the mirror.
Well, when a team goes on a losing streak near the end of a season, the sports writers usually say, well, they've kind of given up on the season. These are professional athletes. Do they really do that?
Well, absolutely. Probably the most important thing that that I learned and that I would pass along is no matter the profession, no matter the athlete, no matter what your line of work is, human nature is always with us. You can get distracted and all of a sudden your priorities change. You can get discouraged. You can get depressed. Whatever it is, you're less than your best. So one thing we always paid attention, what's the frame of mind in our club? And one of the things happened, just because you get paid to play doesn't mean that you care about how much you win.
I'm assuming some players do not have to be talked to very much, but you have a philosophy, communicate 75% of the time to 25% of the team?
Well, that's a nice formula for the major issues. And I clarify that, but we communicate to everybody every day. That's part of this relationship building and maintaining. But when you have the major issues, when you stand in front of the team and you want, and say we have three big points today, this is how we're going to do this, A, B, C. You're speaking as a coach, and a lot of guys in that room are looking at you, he's the coach. And in their own mind, you're thinking, okay, when the coach is over, then we'll see what. Well, if you get the 25% of the leaders on the team and you convince them ahead of time, look, let's challenge me. I say it's A, B, C. What do you think it should be? We finally agree. When you have that meeting and you walk out, we call them co-signers. The guys that are left there will say, oh, well, he said the left door. I'm going out the right door. And the co-signer says, no, we're going out the left door, like he said. So it's a very powerful concept.
Well, We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about this and how you develop chemistry on a team with my guest, Tony La Russa, the third winningest manager in the history of baseball. And when you consider how many great managers there have been, that's quite a feat. He has written, with the help of Rick Hummel, One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball, 10 and a Half Games Back, and One Final Championship Season, published by William Morrow. Stay with us. We're back with Tony La Russa. He has written a book with the help of Rick Hummel and a foreword by John Grisham called One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball, 10 and a Half Games Back, and One Final Championship Season. It's published by William Morrow. When a team is struggling, well, first of all, when they hire a manager, they often say, you know, we need somebody who can communicate with the players. Then when they fire him, they usually say, well, he was too easygoing. He had said during the time he was there that these are all mature adults and you have to treat them as such. We need a disciplinarian. And then the disciplinarian comes in and we hear, well, the reason the team isn't doing well is because they hate him. He's, you know, he doesn't communicate with the players. So what's the real story here?
Well, I think both could be true. You can have someone that comes in and does not hold the player accountable. It's too easy on him. You can have somebody that comes in there and has no bedside manner, and it's always, you know, half empty rather than half full. And the fact is, it's a very difficult game to play. You are playing against another team that has talent. They're trying to win. Sometimes you get beat. And I think the answer is that you're taught to be perceptive and sensitive and just as honest as you can be. And you know, if you have qualified coaches, you know, you're comparing and you're trying to read. Is this guy trying too hard? Does he need a little shove in the right direction? But the best managers that I ever played for and the ones that I admire the most have the ability. It's called pat and pop. You know, they'll pat you on the butt, pat you on the back when you deserve it, but they'll also pop you in the butt if you're going sideways. And you can go sideways. And I just think in the end, I don't think there's one personality. You can be quiet, be very effective. Walter Alston, you know. You can be loud and funny. Tom Lasorda, Sparky Anderson. I just think you got to be true to your personality, but you have to establish those elements of, you know, get the respect and have them trust you.
On the other hand, what about team chemistry? You have 25 people coming from different parts of the world, different education levels, different everything, different politics, different kinds of personalities. I'd imagine it's almost impossible for everybody to get along.
No, but see, I don't want to, at the risk, because I know that you follow this closely, I hope you're not one of the people that has an opportunity to speak on TV or radio, but I flinch or write. Chemistry is overrated, they'll say. And my answer is, if you stop and think about a baseball situation, you start in mid-February, if you're doing well, you make play till Halloween. You're with those guys virtually every day. You're with them more in your real family. Don't you think that the relationships between each player is critical to how you go about your daily challenge of competing? So we put chemistry right at the top of the list, tied for first with things like how much effort and how well we play the game.
Because there are some players who get reputations for being clubhouse poison.
Right.
And they really can just poison the whole attitude of the team?
Absolutely. And that's where I do believe that you have a leadership function. And what we try to do, we share the leadership. I mean, I have the biggest office, so I'm the manager, I'm the leader. But you know, I delegate to our players. So we will not allow a poisonous leader, a player in that clubhouse to exist. We're going to try. We won't give up on him, but we're going to try and remind him that that's not what's the most productive.
Well, your team's leader, many people call him the best living ball player, was Albert Pujols. Was he also somebody who took on a leadership function?
Absolutely. And the point I make, Leonard, is in the healthiest situation, you try to have a number of them because Albert may get hurt. He may have a period where he's, you know, distracted by a family situation. He's not himself. So you want to have a number of them. Last year, for example, the 25-man roster, we probably had 8 to 10. And that's really healthy. And it doesn't have to be the most – it could be a young guy that comes in and establishes himself. He has to be sincere, and he has to demonstrate that respect, trust thing every day.
Well, here you have Pujols, mm-hmm. who, as I said, many people think is the greatest living ball player, and you win the World Series, and then the team lets him go. I suspect you weren't part of that decision.
No, I wasn't, and I was caught in the middle even after the fact because I wasn't around, because I worked 16 years for that organization with outstanding ownership, very good front office with Walt Jockley and now John Mozeliak. So I saw their side of it, and then I had the great privilege of watching this great player, Albert Pujols, for 11 years. And I said, blame the system. The system is I'm a free agent, and if somebody will give you that huge contract, then it's – unless you make an effort, which Albert did, to give a hometown discount, you're going to lose that guy unless you're one of the clubs that can just print money.
Because St. Louis is a large city, but not one of the largest cities in the country. You can't really rely on the kind of fan support that New York or Boston or Chicago or Oakland?
Well, we get the fan support. Now, we have drawn 3-2 to 3-5, I think 11 or 12 out of the 16 years I was there. What you don't get, a whole lot of TV money. So some of the extras that you would get. Plus, we built a new ballpark in 2006. I don't believe there's very much state and city financing. The owners are repaying that debt.
The owners are no longer the owners of Budweiser?
Yeah. A curious thing, during the winter of 95, when I was negotiating to go there, they were. And just as I got ready to sign, they let me know that soon thereafter they're going to put the club up for sale. They would sell it to a local group, which they did. And that, so in effect, every year that I managed, it was for the new group, not the Bush family.
Tony La Russa is my guest. He's written a book called One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball, 10 and a half games back, and One Final Championship Season. It has a foreword by John Grisham, and it's published by William Morrow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When people analyze the end of a season, why a team succeeded or failed, they often talk about how the manager handled his bullpen. He used a guy too much. He didn't use him enough. He put him in the wrong situations. Is that a major part of your job?
Very interesting point, because I think of the decisions that you make during the game, the most important ones are handling your pitching, which in today's baseball means anytime you make a decision, go to the bullpen, and it's usually more than one reliever. So it's a very fair analysis to make of a struggling team. Did that manager and that pitching coach, did they handle the pitching and the bullpen right? It is a larger question. There are position players that you need to coach and prepare and use smartly during the year. You have your starting pitchers. But I do believe in today's baseball, it's been one of the evolvements. Just like years ago when they started throwing a slider and Ted Williams, hey, where'd that come from? Yeah. Now the use of the bullpen and hitters having to hit these specialty relievers, they dominate the last 3 to 4 innings of just about every game.
When you managed the Oakland A's, you started using a former starter, Dennis Eckersley, in the bullpen, specifically as a ninth inning closer. A lot of pitchers who were starters don't want that role.
Well, at that time, that was just, I would say, paying attention to using relievers late. Started, in the 70s, because I remember the A's, Dick Williams, 72-3, they used relievers. But relievers were extended, Raleigh Fingers and the Gossages, Sparky Lyles. They pitched two, three. Really limiting, maybe we did start it, but it wasn't me. I couldn't have been more fortunate since 1983 to work with, in my opinion, the greatest pitching coach of all time, Dave Duncan. And in 1988, we had a wonderful offseason engineered by our general manager, Sandy Alderson. We took a 500 club, and we added like 8 pieces that was, holy smokes, on paper, we look great. And Dave asked me, he says, do you think we're good? I said, I think we're really good. He says, do you have anybody in the ninth inning better than Eck? I said, no. He says, well, if we're going to be ahead of a lot of games, don't you think the more often Eck is available, the more we'll win? I said, you're right. And it was Dave's idea. But here's the two criteria. You have to have a really good club So if you don't save your guy, if you're only going to be ahead two or three times. And secondly, you need to have the setup guys, the get outs in the seventh and eighth, so that you have the luxury of saving it for the ninth.
Well, it's all changed. When I was a kid, Don Newcomb pitched both ends of a doubleheader once. Today, Don Newcomb would have pitched 106 pitches, and he'd been taken out.
Yeah, it's a shame, and there's a lot of griping about that. In fact, there is a piece in Last Strike about the conversion of Dennis Eckersley, and he was signed in the earlier time, and he knew that relievers were guys that were not good enough to start, so he was not happy with that.
That's all changed, obviously. But then we have a situation like Johan Santana. He pitches a perfect game, and that may have actually ruined his season and maybe his career.
Well, I happened to be in New York the night, and I watched that, and I'm a big fan of Terry Collins. And usually when I watch the game, I'm watching the game, but I'm really sympathizing with the managers. And he was in a really, really tough spot, and because I happened to have his number when it was over, I sent him a message. I think I called him, might have texted him and say, I think you did the right thing, no matter what happens down the road. Now, he ended up down the road. He didn't pitch as well, and he got hurt. But he had already been hurt, and I think, in my opinion, now, that's the best thing about opinions and strategy, others can differ. It was such a magical moment in Mets history. I think that Santana has that. The fans have that. The Mets history has that. I think Terry did the right thing, even though it ends up that he got hurt. I think he'd have got hurt anyway.
As long as we're talking about the Mets, a listener has written in to ask, what insanity led you to decide not to start Ari Dickey in this year's All-Star game?
I think, first of all, it's Dave Duncan.
For sentimental reasons.
Dave Duncan and Tony La Russa, been around a long time, and we had a very difficult call. We recognize the year that Ari was having. In fact, the year before, he beat up the Cardinals, and we couldn't hit him. But we weighed a couple of things. Number one, one outstanding season versus what Matt Cain had done building up to being the number one guy. He had pitched a perfect game, so he was no slouch. We also looked at you look for edges, and we looked at the edge where Buster Posey, his catcher, was going to be the National League starter. And Buster is a converted infielder. So we thought, that's a heck of a challenge in twilight as another consideration. We had two guys, Ruiz and Molina, who were wonderful. We said, we're going to hold Dickey for when, as it turned out, Molina was gone for a family reason. And he pitched when Ruiz caught. So combination of what Cain deserved, and we thought strategy-wise it was better for the National League.
So that's the way managers think. You managed a number of young players who won the Rookie of the Year Award, Mark McGwire, Ron Kittle, Walt Weiss, Ozzie Guillen. Can you spot something special in a player when he comes up from the minors?
I think yes. Yes, I think it's not anything that's unique to me. I think it's unique to anybody that's had a baseball background, that's been around long enough. The guy that has the talent. The one thing that you don't know until given the chance, for example, in 1987, our shortstop Griffin got hurt. So we played Walt Weiss, the AAA shortstop. In September, we still had a chance to win, and he was wonderful. One of the ways you check a shortstop out, you're winning in the ninth inning, there's a guy on third base, can tie the game, ground ball to short, sure hands, throws it out. Well, the next year they trade, and Walt became our shortstop. So there's ways that you evaluate. I'll give you a cute one. In spring training this year, when I went around making my visits for the commissioner, I saw Albert, and he pointed to Mike Trout. He says, that's the best-looking young player I've ever seen, and he certainly is a great one.
Albert Pujols, a talent scout as well.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first learn of the use of human growth hormones by Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire?
I think there's – maybe I'm wrong, but there's performance enhancing and there's human growth. I didn't really learn about Jose's until – I guess he wrote that he was doing it in the minor leagues. I didn't see it – something special with him into the 90s, and that was when – he stopped working as hard as he had been working, and he was still getting as big as ever. That's suspicious. In Mark's case, I always saw him work. To this day, he works.
You're talking about lifting weights and things.
Right. Now, The HGH, is, I think, is a very unique kind of problem because you can get, could have gotten, probably, I don't know if you still can, a formula, I mean a prescription, because some doctors believe it speeds the process and it was legal. Mark at that time had these heel. He missed like 100 and some games over 2 years because of his heels. So I think what Pettit did, Rick and Keel, they think their career is over. I got to do something to get as well as possible. So there is a difference between HGH and performance enhancing. Performance enhancing, never acceptable. I think you cut people slack for HGH because if a doctor writes a prescription and you're holding out against all hope that you can continue to play.
So what's next for you? A bookstore? More work with animal with your Animal Rescue Foundation?
Well, ARF's work, we're 22 years old now. We're so inspired by it. It's better than ever. That's always going to be there. I love books. I have actually talked back home to a lady for a little unique spot. But, you know, I 50 years, I know nothing but baseball. I'm fortunate the commissioner has given me something to do. At some point, just to stay in the competition, I probably will join some team in the office and win or lose and be happy or sad.
You mean manage again?
No, upstairs.
Tony La Russa, with the help of Rick Hummel, has written One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball, 10 and a half games back, and One Final Championship Season, has a foreword by John Grisham. It's published by William Morrow. Thank you so much for being with us again.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, Leonard. Thank you.